Hello and welcome to Open Mind UFO Radio. I am your host, Alejandro Rojas, and I am joined with Martin UFO activist Willis.
Yes, that's me.
Are you an activist? Would you call yourself an activist?
Yes, but I don't know what I'm activating for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. See, and I asked that question because, to be honest, I the story... Because I don't know what I'm going to call you until it actually comes out of my mouth.
I figured that had to be it.
And, you know, I saw my eyes just glanced into the story that, the news story I'm going to talk about first. And I decided to call you that just to bring up the topic is and whether you do think of yourself as an activist.
Well, I suppose I am in some type of way. You know, I'm someone... looking for the answer of, you know, what's flying around in the skies, but I'm realistic to think that I, you know, an answer may never be available, but still, I'm exploring the topic. Mm-hmm. So is that, I don't know if you'd consider that an activist or just someone with an interest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 'Cause I ask myself that question often, am I an activist? And I feel like I used to be, I mean, when in Colorado, the first UFO conference that I put together myself was just this day-long thing called the Colorado UFO Briefing, and I had to petition the freedom of speech thing to get this space right in front of the Capitol in Denver, and so I could do it there, you know, right at the Capitol, and I did it, and that was an activist sort of thing. I did that. Mm-hmm. Outside for a couple of years, and then moved it into a university that was nearby for a couple of years. But I was doing that every year, just a one day of a few speakers. It was a lot of fun. But that was sort of – back then I did feel like an activist. These days I don't feel like an activist. I feel like kind of like you said, more of an enthusiast, and it's kind of like a news thing. It's my beat, you know, covering it. So it's more newsy than it is activism. But I guess at the same time, it is spreading awareness.
Right.
And I certainly feel like I'm spreading awareness.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it may not be people like Stephen Bassett or, you know, or we may not be people that are out there like trying to get disclosure, but mm-hmm. we're at least causing awareness. I think that's one thing we can be totally guilty of.
Yeah. I definitely would call Bassett an activist. Otherwise, there's a lot of people interested, but I don't know how many I would call necessarily an activist, you know? And I think a lot of people really like Bassett for that reason. He's actively out there pounding on the White House door, you know? And there aren't many people really doing that.
Right. Yep.
So,
for sure.
Yeah. So, UFO, let me change that. Martin, UFO enthusiast Willis.
There, that's better.
Well, welcome back, Martin, and welcome back to me, because I was on vacation, as many of you probably noticed when you tried to listen to a show last week. However, I did warn you that I was going to be gone, so hopefully some of you didn't get too upset. Luckily, I did get through my email, and I didn't have people saying, where's the show? So luckily, people noticed or heard us earlier and say that, heard me say I would be at the beach. And I was, and I have gone vine crazy. I don't know if you've noticed this, Martin, but I've gone vine crazy. I love doing vines. So if you go to my Facebook, and hopefully a lot of you follow me on Facebook because I post all my stories there and my various adventures, as mundane and non-adventurous as they may be. But I've been doing vines you know, which are the short little video, 6 second video clips of what I'm doing and everything. And it's fun. I've got some of the beach, you know, me flying a kite on the beach. But to interest to paranormal people, I did go on the San Diego ghost tour thing, you know, where you drive around to these ghost sites. And I did a Vine of that. And it's kind of funny because I did a bit of debunking, because we go to this one spot where they take out a key and they say, this is a key to the house and look, it's haunted. And he holds it in his hand and it moves. Then he hands the key around, which he probably shouldn't have done. And I notice that the key, the way it's balanced, that if you slightly move, it's balanced so, and I guess I hear now, people have told me online, that it's a magic trick, so it's balanced that way on purpose. But all you have to do is very slightly. If you move your hand quickly, it spins quickly. But if you move your hand very slowly where people can't even see, then it moves slowly. So I showed my girlfriend and her daughter. I was like, look, the ghost is moving the key. And they're like, what? And then I said, look, the ghost is moving it back. And I moved it back. And they're like, how did you figure it out? How did you do that? So I passed it around and then I told them the secret later. But it was fun. I mean, they were very entertaining, very interesting tour. And haunted San Diego. It was a lot of fun.
You should have done Uri Geller and, like, made this the key bend.
That would have been really cool. Too bad I didn't think of that, and too bad I don't know how to make things bend with my mind. But
that part, too.
Yeah, I should have practiced. And it would have been weird, because I know these people who used to do that. They'd have parties where they say they'd do it, and they would yell at the objects. They would go, rah, and yell at it. So that would have been especially weird if I started yelling at this key. They would have thought I was possessed, I guess.
Yeah. Well, now, is that like, isn't there a site called Snapchat or something like that where you can post little tiny?
Well, Snapchat, yeah, you can post, and the videos only stay for a day. Pictures or video. You can post them to My Story, and then that shows what you're doing that day, and they go away. But that's the whole point with Snapchat, is that the pictures go away. So you can take pictures or videos, and it's intended where you send them to somebody. So I would take a picture of me on the beach and send it to you, or maybe I see these girls on the beach and I want you to see them, so I'd take a picture and send it to you, and then it would disappear. And that way your girl, you know, it would disappear, and your girlfriend says, what's that? And you would say, nothing. Oh, it's gone. It was a picture of the beach. And, you know, that way she doesn't know, because it's sneaky.
Yeah.
And that's how a lot of people get in trouble, because there are ways to make a screenshot and save those pictures. So you could save your girlfriend sending you those pictures, and then you know, some people, once they split and they get mad, they post them online, and it causes a lot of problems. But
what a world. What a world we're in.
But yeah, Snapchat's a little more private, whereas Vine is like sending it to the world, and lots of people look at it. And this picture of when I went to the beach last time with my girlfriend's dog, it was his first time at the beach, so I got a video of him in slow motion, and I made a Vine of that, and that's the Vine, the only Vine really that I've had that's really gone viral, is the dog running on the beach. But he's a cute fellow. But I did some in Roswell too, and at the Roswell Museum. So if you want to see what the Roswell Museum looks like, you can look at my Vines, which are on Facebook, and those have gotten quite a few. I've gotten Daryl Sims on a Segway yelling "Yeehaw," and that one's got about 500. Loops where people have looked at it.
Amazing world.
Funny place we're in. Speaking of a funny place, the Southwest is a funny place. And our guest today is kind of an expert of the Southwest, and that is Noe Torres. So I've interviewed Noe with Ruben before, Ruben Uriarte. And Noe and Ruben worked together on Roswell Books, and they've written a few books together. Noe has also written a book with another researcher called Cowboys and Aliens, and we're going to talk about how that came about and that book, which is really interesting. So it's essentially, you know, really old UFO sightings, which is a lot of fun. And but he also, you know, It's looked into other cases in the Southwest and in Mexico, and we'll talk to Noe about that. And it was really interesting because I went to Vegas a couple weekends ago. I think, well, I made some vines of that too, but Noe had shown some news articles about Area 51 I hadn't seen before that were really interesting. So we're going to talk about that as well. So a very fun interview today with Noe Torres.
He's a great guy. I've talked
He
to him before. Nice
is a
guy.
really great guy, and it was fun because he's always wanted to walk around the strip in Las Vegas. And his wife doesn't like Vegas, and Ruben would rather sit at a well, Ruben would rather sit and watch instead of walk around so much. I think Ruben has knee problems too. So he was so happy that I love walking. I'm not really a drinker or a gambler, neither is Noe. I love to walk the strip and look at the people and look at the cool things they have all over. And so we did that for hours and one night, late into the night or early into the morning, and it was a lot of fun. So it was the first time I got to spend much time with Noe, but it was a lot of fun.
You pretty much see some interesting characters in Vegas, that's for sure.
No doubt about it. You see, almost as many interesting characters in Vegas as you see at UFO conferences.
That's right. Did you see any tall whites by chance?
Yep, tall
Yeah, they're
whites,
pretty close, you know, they live pretty close to that.
short browns, all types, all colors and types. All right, so let's get into the news. UFO news. What do you think? Want to talk about some UFO news?
Sounds good, and I'll start as usual if you'd like. And what I'd like
Yeah.
to talk about today is Roger Marsh wrote an article, Indonesia witness videotapes a slow-moving UFO. And a witness in Jakarta, Indonesia, was outside at a basketball field. Now, I think a lot of this is lost in translation here. He's out there with his wife and toddler on July 17th. And this is a quote from him. First, notice the object when pointing out hunting bats and swallows to my son. So I'm sure there's a lot of things lost in the translation,
Yeah.
but he actually was, made the effort to, contact MUFON and make this case available. And it's kind of an interesting one. If you look at the video on Open Minds, you can see it's a vertical shot of this, and you have to look really close. That's a problem with that. He filmed it on an iPhone 5, and it looks really, really tiny, but you can see it. And you have to actually expand the screen to see it. And I have a good sized Mac to do that on. And it is very unusual because at first I'm thinking, well, he's talking about it changes shape and stuff like that. I'm thinking a balloon, but all of a sudden it starts to do these weird maneuvers and moves all around. And it's really, and then it goes back to original shape and all that. So I'm not sure exactly how long he actually witnessed it for, but at one point he says it looked kind of like a red blood cell. I thought that was a very, very unusual description. He must be in the medical field or something to have said something like that. But
Yeah.
anyway, it's a cool video and you should check it out. It's really, it's quite interesting.
Yeah, this video is kind of weird. I don't know why. I kind of feel because it's jittery, it might be CGI. And
Oh.
then when I made the feature image for it has this like boxy effect. And I don't know if that's just the video, the differences in colors, it isn't a smooth transition, so it creates this boxiness, or if that's due to some CGI. I'm not like a CGI expert, so I don't know, and I haven't heard anybody. Lee Spiegel, we were talking, he actually sent me an email, and he said, the guy says, and he does say here, that it was somewhat spherical, moving at a constant speed and constant altitude, when it obviously wasn't moving at a constant speed. Just like you noticed in the video, it's jerky. It makes this weird jerky kind of movement. And so, I don't know, that kind of threw up some red flags for me. Otherwise, I mean, if it's not a hoax, its movement doesn't indicate a balloon. So it would be kind of weird if it isn't a CGI kind of thing. So, yeah, very mysterious video.
It also looks like it's being filmed right in a big, huge field of cannabis, but it's probably something else. I don't know if you noticed that.
I didn't even notice that till you said something.
Yeah.
And I'm going to look closer. I'm not going to say I'm some sort of cannabis expert. but I know people who are.
Well, you know, I mean, it could be the case why he thinks it was moving steady.
Yeah, and it wasn't. That could be. It was actually on my birthday. This thing was filmed, though, it looks like.
Oh.
That's kind of cool.
Happy belated birthday.
Yeah. No problem there. So another video that has gotten a lot, and I would love to hear your impression on this because we haven't talked about it, even though it's been out there for a couple weeks now, and it's been making the news, is this one over Osaka, Japan. So nobody has the details behind when it was taken or anything like that, and people are very suspicious of, you know, some of these UFO sites that have been posting this video. But there's this video of, you know, these several lights hovering over, kind of moving over Osaka. And this is kind of suspect to me. And I'm a Godzilla fan, right? And if you played the video games or if you watch the movies, Godzilla loves to attack Osaka. And I think Osaka is actually bigger than Tokyo. I think it's the biggest city. But there's the iconic, like, power station with the towers that are red and white that Godzilla always attacks. And that's where this video is. These UFOs happen to be in that location, which also makes it a little suspicious. I think it might be CGI. It looks kind of strange. Plus, we don't have much information. You know, the media's run wild with it, and they're posting it all over the place. But I'm sure you've seen this video.
I have, and it's too bad that I know Mark D'Antonio is still under the weather pretty seriously. Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear his opinion on this. And I believe there was a very similar sighting in Milwaukee, within a few days apart from this one.
Yeah, that's what they say, although the Milwaukee one, if I remember correctly, was at night. So that one did look like it was probably Chinese lanterns. This one's during the day, so I don't know that it's Chinese lanterns. One of the newspapers, one of the British newspapers, said it looked like these UFOs that were spotted during a Blur concert in Hyde Park, but those, you know, were determined, and I think if you watch the video, you can tell those are light reflections from all the bright lights on the stage. So, yeah, kind of.
You know, I would think if someone was going to go through the trouble of CGI on this video, they'd put Godzilla in there somewhere, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, I think that would be really cool.
Yeah, they could.
It's
have
not them. Hard to do. There was a MUFON thing. Speaking of Mark D'Antonio, he sent me some pictures, a group of us some pictures, because at the MUFON training camp, he had a drone that he was flying around, and he flew one around at night with IR, with infrared, so he got this night vision of the ground and the people walking around. And so I took that picture, and it took me maybe 20 minutes to Photoshop in a Godzilla. and then I took one of the other pictures and Photoshopped in the Predator. And I was like, oh, my God, what else? You guys should be careful. Look what else was out there. Very convincingly, too. So you're right. It doesn't take long to do that.
Yeah.
And that would have been more fun.
That's pretty funny. Yeah.
So here's the other story I wanted to talk to you about. So I spent a lot of time on this story. And typically, this is as it goes, I spend a lot of time researching a story that I think is very significant, but it doesn't have a UFO picture or video in it, so it doesn't get a whole lot of attention. But I'm proud of myself for putting this all together. But this is kind of cool. There were some declassified files, and they were actually declassified several years ago by Dr. David Clark. He is a UFO folklore expert, he calls himself. He's actually a senior lecturer in journalism at Sheffield Hallam University in the UK. And you might have heard of him. In fact, when the UK government releases UFO files, you know, we usually hear from Nick Pope because he's more out there, and you know, we all know him very well. He goes to the conferences. But David Clark actually is the guy who officially kind of writes something up on the UK government's website about those UFO files. And he's a skeptic, but he is really into the topic, and he did some FOIAs to get some information about this group called the Special Branch. It's a part of the Scotland Yard, who is officially the UK's Metropolitan Police. They're responsible for national security, and he did a FOIA to find out what they had done regarding UFOs and stuff. And he found some interesting stuff, and he wrote about this and released this in 2005. And however, the Daily Telegraph and the Daily Express said that these files were just released recently. And I'm not sure why they're saying that. David Clark didn't seem to know why they were saying that either, because he did write about, you know, their stories. But they seem to think the files were released recently, where he points out that, no, I wrote about them in my book, and I released them prior. But this has brought, you know, this information to the forefront again, and it's very interesting. So the Special Branch was looking into what they called new religious movements. And this was actually a paper that came out in the 90s, and it was due to the suicide of something Gate, Heaven's Gate.
Oh yeah, Heaven's Gate. Oh, when they thought Hale Bopp.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So after Heaven's Gate, they decided, we better look into this stuff to see if any other groups are doing this sort of thing. So they started to look for some of these UFO religions. And weirdly enough, they decided that, you know, some of these cults start up around UFOs and sci-fi. So they better watch people who are interested in certain sci-fi television shows, including Roswell, The X-Files, Millennium, Dark Skies, Star Trek, and The Lawnmower Man. So, kind of funny. And I put a picture in of Dark Skies because it's our good buddy Bryce Zabel, who was kind of the creator of Dark Skies. And Dark Skies was a television show in the 90s. It was kind of like, I can't remember which station. I think it might have been ABC or NBC, but it was kind of their answer to The X-Files. But it was full of actual, you know, MJ-12 and mythology, you know, and some of the conspiracy stuff out there about UFOs, which was interesting. But Bryce Zabel, you know, give a shout out to Bryce because he helped develop that. So it was really interesting. But then he also had another document that actually this is what the Daily Express wrote more about, was there was a religion out there that the Special Branch watched more closely. And these were called the Arthurians. And this was in the 50s, late 50s, and when they started looking at this guy, and into the 60s. So this is a cult, and I talk about them actually in my lecture on UFOs and religion as an example of a new religion that has resulted from, you know, the belief in aliens and everything. And this was started by a guy named George King. This is a familiar story to all of us. In fact, and no offense to any of these people, but I receive an email practically on a daily basis. Hi, I'm talking to aliens, and the aliens are telling me this, and I need to share this information. I would like to speak at the UFO Congress, or I'd like to be a guest on your radio show, because I need to get this information about the aliens. And some people might be saying, oh my God, why aren't you sharing this stuff then? Well, here's the problem, is that everybody's story's different. And how am I supposed to know who to believe? And, I used to be more interested in this kind of idea, but I've gotten, to be honest, completely bored with it because it's like all I'm doing is, all that would be doing is bringing on these people who are saying, here's what the aliens told me. The next day I would have someone else saying, here's what the aliens told me. And we have all these different stories that don't jive. Because they never do. And I always ask people who are like, oh, do you like this person who's talking to aliens? Or do you read books about this person who's talking to aliens? And I'm like, well, do you believe those people are really talking to aliens? Oh, yeah. Well, then why are their stories different? Why are they saying, sometimes they're even saying reptilians are bad, they're eating people, or reptilians are great, I'm having sex with them. Unfortunately, that's a common theme,
I've
having
heard
sex with
that.
reptilians. So, I mean, they're all over the place, these stories. But this is one of those guys who started a religion over this. But he seems like a really nice guy. He actually channeled on BBC. They showed this on BBC television in 1959, where he says he was channeling an alien. And so that was some concern, but essentially it was some interesting enough. David Clark did more research to find out more details about what happened, and it was this right-wing newspaper that said, "Oh, this guy is spouting some new agey, communist rhetoric, and this is dangerous." And so that's kind of what really brought him into the scene. The special branch took a look at him, but they found out he had no relations to communists. He was the first guy to put together a march for UFO disclosure, so he was one of the first UFO activists, and that's why I talk about the UK government monitoring UFO activists. But really interesting. So I want to talk about this story with you, but first of all, I do want to ask, I mean, your thoughts about all the channelers.
I've never really looked into it. To me, it sounds, kind of woo-woo, out there. But, I try to keep an open mind, but I just, and I, some people listening may not like me for saying this, but it just seems kind of hokey to me. Like, I don't know. I mean, is there, what are your thoughts on it? I just don't know if I believe
Well,
it's
the
real.
issue I think is okay. I think it's completely possible. There's no doubt. To me, I think it's completely possible that maybe some advanced civilization that knows how to use, knows how to tune into our brain waves, or maybe even knows how to use telepathy, is sending messages. But first of all, is that a very effective way to do it? Because then only one person has this supposed message, and who's going to believe this one person? And okay, so let's say, and this may be a conspiracy, well, maybe the government is sending out all these other people so you don't know who's real or who's not. Well, if that's the case, then us lowly stupid humans are that easily able to thwart the plans of these aliens. So that's bad on two folds. One, these aliens can't be that intelligent. They must be idiots if it's that easy to, thwart their plans. And that's the biggest problem. I mean, these guys are dumb. Can't they come up with something better than that? I could come up with something better than that, I think. But so it just doesn't work out. And the worst case scenario, maybe some people, maybe even like David Jacobs would say, oh, they're all evil messages and they're trying to really screw with us. Well, then we shouldn't listen to them at all. So I don't see any good productive reason for. I think it's an interesting thing. I think looking at the idea overall is really interesting. And I do, and I will say this, I do, those cases, like let's say Travis Walton or the guys in Maine that we had, I made such a big deal about, and you had them on your show. Who have all this evidence around their alleged alien abductions, or their at least they had seen UFOs, multiple witnesses. And I think what their impressions are post experience are really interesting, and I like listening to those. But otherwise, it's difficult to make heads or tails of anything else.
Well, it's because, you know, it's because there's 57 different varieties of alien beings.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
That's a good point. It's a good point.
Yeah.
So,
just wondered if you thought of that.
I do think of that. Let me tell you what I think of that. Actually, I do. But this is kind of interesting that the special branch had been looking at these things, although looking at X-Files. See, I fit into a lot of these. I show a picture of a bunch of Star Trek nerds at a Star Trek convention. Not to say I wouldn't be one of these people, because I am a Star Trek nerd. And I wrote, these are apparently the types of nefarious characters at Scotland Yard. Keep an eye on. But it does make sense, especially after Heaven's Gate, that, you know, they had to do something. And it does raise alarms that maybe we need to look at this stuff more closely. And although I think you probably took some heat and I took some heat when we talked about, you know, this last time we were together, people being careful about these cults and stuff. Mm. But they should. Sorry, stand by what I said.
Well, I think, you know, in regards to all that, it doesn't matter if it's aliens. It doesn't matter if it's an invisible being in the clouds or underwater or whatever. Cults or so-called religions can attract, you know, people with all these different ideas. So I don't know if one is any more dangerous than the other, you know.
I think Heaven's Gate was pretty dangerous because they ended up committing suicide. Yeah. But and I think, you know, the nefarious part is what kind of makes a cult by definition. But there are Therians I don't like to call a cult because and that's the point in – and that's why I choose them to talk about in my lecture about UFOs and religion is that they are a very positive cult. I mean, even as far as religions go – looking at their beliefs and, you know, the tenets that they follow, they're very positive and inclusive. They talk about how we're not the only answer, you know, that they think all religions are important and they believe in a oneness. All of these very positive things that if you're an Arthurian, I would feel more comfortable with there being more Arthurians than other established religions out there, because this is an example where just because Heaven's Gate happened doesn't mean that all of these UFO religions are bad or evil. Some of them, like the Arthurians, are very peaceful and positive and not necessarily a bad thing. I don't personally understand the whole subscribing to a religious belief thing because I'm not one of those people that does. But at least these guys are really positive, and they seem like good guys.
Wow.
So are the Trekkies, for the most part.
The one thing I always think of is it always seems to boil down to money. Someone has to give money somehow. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, was this the case as far as any of the research you've done or not?
It doesn't seem like they are so much into money. It doesn't seem money-based. It seems like this guy genuinely believed. You know, I think it's possible he could be just accessing his what would some would call higher self, just a Jung believed we all have this kind of pool of wisdom inside of ourselves. And once we can look past our emotional problems or all of our issues, we can access this well of wisdom. A lot of people feel that meditation can take you there and things like that. It could be that, you know, just in this state, he was channeling just another part of his psyche where holds to these basic tenets of, you know, treating people like you want to be treated and stuff like this. That's a possibility. But it does seem that this is – he was a genuine – believed in, you know, helping people as opposed to money. Although in the paperwork – the UK government did speculate that maybe he was doing this all for money, but it doesn't seem like he really made a lot of money off of this, and it wasn't like Scientology, where it does take large amounts of money in order to, you know, reach certain levels. So it doesn't seem like money was it. Just seemed like, you know, everybody wanting to believe in a very positive kind of system and worldview where they can, you know, feel good about each other and helping other people.
Well, that part makes me almost want to join.
Yeah, let's go.
Yeah.
So we'll look into that, and maybe next show we'll be spouting the tenets of the Arthurians and talking you all into joining along with us.
Yes.
We don't have to shave our heads or anything weird like that, it doesn't look like either.
No, but so we'll ask good. The people for money.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's the one thing we'll do.
Yep. Yeah. So get your checkbooks ready, people.
All right.
Well, I think that's enough for news. I really didn't have a whole lot of news from last week because I was gone. So I was back on Friday so I could post some stuff for the weekend for people. But that's about all.
Yeah. I think we talked for quite a while, though.
We did. Probably too long.
Nah.
Never. All right. Well, great. Thank you. So thanks, Martin, very much for joining us.
My pleasure, as always.
Just because you're an enthusiast and not an activist, apparently still does not mean you won't be observed by the government. You probably have a special agent of some sort dedicated to monitoring your every move.
I'm sure. Men in black, outside the door, all that stuff.
Yeah. So yeah. Watch your back, buddy. Watch your back. All right. And we will talk to you in a couple days or next week or whenever we do next.
You bet. Sure, in a couple days.
But for now, let's go ahead and talk to Mr. Noe Torres. I am super excited to welcome our guest, Noe Torres. Hello, Noe.
Hello, Alejandro. Thank you for inviting me to be on your show. I'm real excited about it.
Yeah, me too. I'm really excited. You know, we got to see, and if people follow our Facebook, they probably saw some of our pictures of Las Vegas just a couple weeks ago, because you did a talk at the National Atomic Testing Museum.
Oh, that was a wonderful time we had in Vegas. We had a wonderful presentation, which I was very grateful that you were there to support us, to take pictures, and to help us with the presentation. So thank you very much. But even more fun was the time we had afterward to spend time with the other researchers, with Ruben Uriarte and the others. And that was just wonderful. Anytime we can get together with like-minded individuals in the UFO field, it's just a fantastic time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. And, you know, the old saying, what happens in Vegas should stay in Vegas. Although what happened for us is pretty mild.
Yeah,
it still should probably stay in Vegas. So I'll attempting to not comment on that part. But your talk, we will talk about that. Shouldn't stay in Vegas. We should talk about that. So, and we will. But before we get into that, and I know we talked about this a little bit, you and Ruben came on a year or two ago, and we discussed a little bit about your background, but I want to talk some more about that. What originally got you interested in this topic?
Okay, well, I actually, there's two parts to that story. One is my childhood, during which I was extremely interested in the topic. Kind of drifted away from it during my college years and, you know, starting my career as a librarian. But then I got back to it. So in the early years, my mother had an amazing encounter in a dark woods near our home here in Mission, Texas, which is in the extreme southern tip of Texas. We're about 15 miles from the border with Mexico. We are near Brownsville in South Padre Island area. So anyway, my mother was out in the amidst the trees because she heard some noises late at night, saw lights, and she went out by herself. My older brothers, I hadn't been born yet, were asleep. And so she went out into the woods and encountered this very strange entity or object that blazed down a bright light around her. She had several dogs, pet dogs at the time, and they were jumping up in the air and snapping their jaws at something above her. And she used to tell me this story, and there would be, she would get to a point in her narrative where I could tell that it really affected her deeply, and she was struggling to form the words. And she told me that, try as she might, it's like her neck muscles were frozen, and she could not lift her head up above to look at the object or entity that was above her. So she had this light show going on around her. The dogs were going wild.
Wow.
And because she was a religious person, she assumed an attitude of prayer, got down on her knees on the ground. And she said, within a few minutes, but she wasn't completely sure of how much time passed. And when she used to tell me this story as a young person, as a teenager later, I didn't have the knowledge of UFO cases to have asked her if there could have been missing time there, which I suspect there might have been. But when she assumed this attitude of prayer, and suddenly she said it was, she described it as someone turning off a light switch. Suddenly the lights went out, the noise, there was this loud noise and commotion above her head. Everything just quit. And at that same instant, the dog stopped barking and just came over very quietly to stand next to her. And this made a tremendous impression upon her, and she told me the story several times. And every time she told it, it was like she was trying to puzzle something out. It's like she was trying to add up everything that happened to her and, you know, try to make some sense of it, and she never could. So as a result of her telling me this story, I went to the school library. I was in grade school at the time, elementary school, and I read every book in the library about UFOs, a lot of Frank Edwards books, a lot of the early UFO literature. This was in the 60s, I should mention, mid-60s. So I became enamored of the UFO subject and the UFO literature. And, you know, it was an interesting situation. I went to school in a very small school district where the library for the entire school district was combined into one. Because we had all the grades K through 12 at a single campus, and the total enrollment for the district was very small. And so the library had quite an extensive collection of material in all subjects. And for some reason, they had a huge collection of UFO books and books about the paranormal. So ironically, I went on to become a librarian, a school librarian myself, and have been a librarian for over 30 years at the college level and at the school, high school level. And if you walk into my library today, Alejandro, you're going to see probably one of the most extensive UFO collections of books that you've ever seen at any school library, or possibly at any library.
At this library, what kind of school is it? Is it a high school?
Yes, I'm currently a librarian at McAllen High School here in South Texas. And
wow, that is really cool. So these high school students have access to one of the largest UFO book libraries.
Not only that, but they come in and talk to me all the time. You know, I've had the good fortune to have been on some TV shows, and the local media has done several interviews, and I've been on the George Norrie Coast to Coast show several times. And so they come in all the time to talk to me, and I have my regular UFO-interested kids. And then I also am asked to speak a lot at local schools and libraries about the topic. It's something that's kind of out of the ordinary, that you don't hear about every day. And so the students, the young people, really like that. And the way I figured, Alejandro, if it's a topic that focuses your mind away from the trivial everyday things of life and broaches subjects like the possibility of life on other planets, exploring outer space, looking beyond us and our planet to the endless possibilities that seem to exist out in the universe, then I think that's a benefit. It helps stir the thinking, I think. So that's my approach. And but, you know, my experience in reading all those books in the 60s, and then, like I say, I kind of drifted away from being involved in the topic for a really long time. But about 15 years ago, I began writing books about local history topics, South Texas history. And one of the books, you know, I had published a couple, and then one of the books I was working on was Legends and Folk Tales of South Texas. So I had a chapter in that book about UFO cases that have occurred here, and there have been a number, surprisingly, dating back to the 1940s and 50s. And while I was doing research for that particular chapter of my South Texas Legends and Folktales book, I kind of became reintroduced to the topic, which had been such a favorite of mine when I had been younger. So one of the cases that I ran across was the reported crash of a UFO in a small plane along the Texas-Mexico border in 1974, which came to be later known as Mexico's Roswell or the Coyame incident. And when I was preparing, you know, my contribution to that subject in the book that I intended to publish, I did some searches on the internet and found that the only person who really had spoken out or had given any sort of interviews about this case was a gentleman named Ruben Uriarte in California. He was at that time and still is the director of MUFON for Northern California. So I contacted Ruben, I think by email first, and I contacted a lot of other people, but Ruben was the first one to respond. Within 5 minutes of my email to him, he responded. He seemed like a very serious guy, and then we later talked by phone. He knew a little bit about the case. He had been interviewed for a documentary for the UFO Files on the History Channel about it. They had done a series of programs on Roswell-like UFO crashes. And one of their programs was called Mexico's Roswell, and it highlighted this particular case, which happened in 1974 along the Texas-Mexico border. So that's how Ruben and I linked up, and I at one point, I don't remember the context, but he seemed to know quite a lot about it, and so I asked him if he'd be interested in doing a book about reported UFO crashes in Texas or in the Southwest, and he said yes. So we looked at three or four that we thought had enough evidence to at least put out there in hopes of exposing the public to it and maybe generating more interest and more evidence. And one of those was the Coyame incident that I've mentioned in 1974, where a small plane and a UFO crashed midair near the small town of Presidio, Texas, over across the Rio Grande River in Mexico. And there were there was another case in Laredo, one in Del Rio. Those were the three main ones that we're going to cover. There was also one that has a lot less background, and that is the reported Laredo UFO crash of 1948. Interestingly enough, all four of those incidents happened along the Texas-Mexico border. And over the years, there have been a number of UFO researchers who have looked into these, all the way from Len Stringfield to Elaine Douglas to Bruce McAbee, Stanton Friedman. So we felt that these, particularly the Koyama case in 74, the reported crash of a UFO in El Del Rio in 1955, and then the incident near, let's see, the other one was Koyama and Del Rio. Koyama and Del Rio were really the main ones that we focused on.
Mm-hmm.
So we were going to do a book in which we covered these three or four reported crashes on the Texas-Mexico border, but we started gathering the information, and we had so much on the 1974 Koyama case that we ended up doing our first book together that was just about the Koyama case. So we published that in 2007. It was called Mexico's Roswell. And we've done a number of documentaries and shows and appearances at conferences about that one book. It continues to be the most talked about of our books, and we get the most interview requests about it.
Mm-hmm.
But Ruben and I have gone on to do seven other books since then about other famous UFO cases. And so that's how it all went, Alejandro. It's been a fascinating ride. Mm-hmm. It's taken us to many places around the U.S. and Mexico.
I want to talk about, you know, because I've had Ruben on. I had you on with Ruben on before. We've talked about some of these crash cases or some of your other work. And I'm sure, you know, we'll have you on again to talk more about this stuff. But I guess a real general question before we move on. Do you feel that UFO crashes then have happened often?
No, I do not. And if you do a search on the internet, you will find claims of hundreds of UFO crashes from the 40s to the present. But if you buckle down and look at each one individually, you'll find that a lot of them, you can safely put in the category of wild speculation with minimal factual material to back them up. So there's a lot of hearsay and a lot of inaccuracies in a lot of those cases. Somebody heard somebody say that when they were in the military, something happened. And
mm-hmm.
So I do not have a high degree of confidence. I do believe there have been UFO crashes, and I tend to be extremely conservative on the number and which particular ones that they might have been. I still have doubts in terms of some of the cases that Ruben and I have looked at, but we felt that it was important to gather the information,
mm-hmm.
publish it, and make it known. And interestingly enough, since our book Mexico's Roswell came out in 2007, in the intervening 8 years, there have been a number of witnesses, I'd say 8 to 10 significant people who added significantly to the story, who have contacted us as a result of our book having published and the interviews that we do. So, you know, the information, I'll be the first to admit that the information on some of these crash cases is extremely weak. It's third-hand information, second and third-hand information. And if we believe what we believe, then we know that this has been kept deliberately secret from the public, and so it's going to be extremely difficult
mm-hmm.
to find that conclusive piece of evidence in terms of documents or in terms of physical evidence that would absolutely, beyond a doubt, fix this as being a true event.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like you and I have talked about earlier, these are fascinating stories, contain a lot of intrigue, and open up a wide range of possibilities. There is also a fascinating historical angle to them. We know that the military has been involved and the intelligence community have been involved in UFO secrecy. And to see how these things progress over the years is extremely interesting.
Yeah, I think what I've learned, and I know I think a lot of people, and this is advice for listeners, because a lot of people get really frustrated, you know, over different aspects of this field. But I think, you know, taking the stance of a researcher or even kind of a historian, gathering the data and the information and putting it together, it's interesting information and it deserves to be told and documented. But if you go about it as I'm going to prove something, it's more problematic because then you've got a bias. And I think you're always going to have this frustration because so many of the rabbit holes you go down or the cases you try to investigate, they often lead to dead ends. Like you said, it turns out to be somebody told somebody who told somebody who told somebody. And you often find that a lot of the claims are not backed up. But the exciting thing is when you find a case that is strong.
You know, that's absolutely true. And probably the most famous UFO researcher in the field of crash retrievals, Leonard Stringfield, who worked mostly in the 60s and 70s, and whose work I greatly admire and have read most of the material he published. He gave, I think, the best description of UFO research. He called it a hall of mirrors. And I always think of that because it's exactly like you say. You're walking down a maze. Things are not what they appear to be. That could be an opening or it could be a mirror that you bump into. Everything is distorted. And just when you think you have something substantial, suddenly the rug gets pulled out from under you. So that's the way these cases are. There are deep, dark elements at work keeping these just below the surface of public knowledge and taking every measure possible, you know, to have the evidence concealed. We don't really know exactly why. There are many theories. But there's just too many incidents that have happened, too many witnesses who have seen things. Even though we don't have a piece of a UFO, well, there are some that might be, but even though we don't have physical proof that's been proven to be a piece of a UFO, and even though a UFO has not landed on the White House lawn, you know, it's a preponderance of cases and evidence and witnesses that lead us to believe that certainly many of these reported cases, the witnesses have no reason to be fabricating this in most cases.
Mm-hmm. So getting to, and that's a good segue, pieces of UFOs. There's an alleged possible piece of a UFO inside the National Atomic Testing Museum in this Area 51 exhibit. And this is something that George Knapp had retrieved from Russia, and supposedly there's some analysis that shows it's anomalous. But what did you think of the Area 51 exhibit? Were you shocked by it?
I thought they did a fantastic job of taking you through the whole history of the base, the early U-2 secret spy mission testing that occurred there at Groom Lake. The UFO angle, Alejandro, I thought understandably was a bit played down. And it was kind of popularist in focus. But that's okay because people associate Area 51 with UFOs, and so therefore the designers of the exhibit, I'm sure, felt compelled to throw in some UFO and ET elements into it. You know, they also gave focus to the research that George Knapp has done, the Dalnogorsk UFO fragment that you mentioned a while ago is a very nice nice thing to include. So all in all, it was it's a tremendous exhibit that everybody should see. It's just unfortunate that they're closing it down permanently as of November 1. But we're hopeful that the exhibit will be transported elsewhere and put on display elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. I was just, when I went, I figured that there might be a little bit of a UFO thing, you know, a small portion. I was surprised how much UFO information was in the exhibit when they opened.
Yeah.
Although, like you said, it's not like a lot of really hard research. It is very popularist and kind of a general overview of things.
Exactly.
But it's great, you know, that they do include it, and they don't really make fun of it.
No.
It's taken seriously, and I think that you probably agree that, especially because I knew him better, I just know the new director of the place. But Alan Palmer, who was a director when they started the exhibit, and Karen, who you work with, who helped organize your talk and all these UFO talks, they love it. They're really into the whole idea, and they really embrace the UFO community.
Well, I've known Karen Green, the curator, for years. She's originally from Texas, and she was formerly the curator at the Sol Ross University Museum here in Texas. So I know her to be a person who's open-minded and very open to the UFO topic. So she contacted me before the exhibit opened and told me what the rationale behind it was, and I really felt that it was going to be a serious exploration of not only Area 51's history, but its tie-in to the UFO phenomenon. And that's exactly what it turned out to be. She did a tremendous job. She did a lot of the design along with other folks. And so because of Karen's involvement, I really felt that it was going to be top-notch. Now, the unique thing, Alejandro, is that the National Atomic Testing Museum is affiliated with the Smithsonian Institution. It's a very respected museum, and it receives a lot of visitors from the general public. It's not a UFO or paranormal slanted facility at all. And so the fact that they embraced this topic and made it a part of what they've done for the past 5 years is just fantastic, and it has,
right.
I think it has shed a lot of light on the field of UFO research and has gotten a lot of people excited and actively involved in it over the past 5 years that this exhibit has been there. And I just enjoyed the heck. That's a top-notch facility there in Las Vegas. If people have traveled to Las Vegas and haven't taken time to see the National Atomic Testing Museum, you really ought to. There's so much there regarding the history of the Cold War and America's involvement in the Cold War and the development of nuclear weapons in Nevada and New Mexico in the 40s. It's an amazing place with lots of history. And, you know, the Area 51 exhibit has been a major part of that over the past 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, the atomic testing part is incredible. You learn so much. They have so much equipment and everything. It's one of the nicest museum displays I've seen. I was just thoroughly impressed with that site. But I wanted to get into your talk there because you talked about Area 51. And you added, because, you know, I've, of course, in this field, you know, we pay attention to Area 51 and all the claims and all of the research. But you had in your talk a lot of stuff I had never seen. And in particular, and this gets to news clippings, which will get us into Cowboys and Aliens. But all of these incredible news clippings going back about Area 51 that I had never seen. And in fact, it's shocking, you know, that Area 51 was mentioned by name in the news so often. But, like, if I can't remember, when was the oldest clipping you had found?
Well, we had one that was actually published before Area 51 opened in 1955. It opened, the facility opened in July 1955, and there was a notice that went out on the wires and was published primarily in Nevada about the facility, a secret facility being constructed. This was published like in March or April. You know, it talked about a couple of contractors had been selected and some of the preliminary work was being done. Now, it didn't give too many details, obviously, but if anybody had been paying attention, and of course it's easy for us Monday morning quarterbacking to go back and say people should have seen this. I introduced during my talk about 20 newspaper articles from 1955 to the 1990s, in which in almost every case there was a mention of Area 51, Groom Lake, top secret development of secret aircraft, and it was most of those articles mentioned specifically Area 51 and Groom Lake. So it's in the literature, it's in the periodicals of the time, but this thread runs through the history of the base, where the military, the U.S. government denied its existence, as everybody knows, until 2013, officially. And yet, anyone that was watching closely could have puzzled this out themselves. Just a simple literature search in the 70s or 80s, even the 90s, would have uncovered the fact. One of the advantages I have as a librarian, Alejandro, is I have access to a lot of databases of archival material. So whenever I focus on a topic like Area 51, I utilize as many of these databases as possible. And so I found a lot of incredible information about Area 51. For example, Clarence Kelly Johnson's UFO sightings the year before Area 51 opened. Clarence Kelly Johnson was a designer of the U-2 spy plane and several other stealth planes that were developed at Area 51, and he's considered one of the founders of Area 51. For God's sakes, he was on the plane that went out scouting for the location and landed, the plane landed on Groom Lake, and they discovered that it was a beautiful natural landing field. So Clarence Kelly Johnson, who was instrumental and one of the founders of Area 51, in documents that were released much later, many years later under the Freedom of Information Act, stated very clearly that he was a believer in flying saucers. And that many working in his group, he said, had also become convinced that these flying objects are real. So there were a lot of there was a lot of information I found in the archives that just kind of floored me. And you know, the connection to UFOs, a lot of people think, didn't come until the Bob Lazar revelations in the mid to late 90s. But actually, there were UFO connections right from the beginning, right from 1954, 1955 time period, which was, by the way, one of the most active time periods for UFO sightings throughout North America. They were very much in the news back then.
And mostly you mean Johnson sighting?
Well, actually, throughout, you know, throughout the United States, there were many, many sightings.
Oh, yeah.
At that time period, yeah. But not just specifically around Nevada.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, you know, this is kind of neat. There was a Shepard Johnson, actually, is a researcher who writes for us once in a while. He found a Blue Book file that referenced Area 51. It was just a UFO sighting where they said, you know, here are the bases around the area. And one of the bases they listed was Area 51. And I think this was a sighting in the 60s or something like that.
There were a lot of interesting documents in there, Alejandro. For example, the Skylab orbital space station mission accidentally took a picture of Area 51, and it was published in several places and became very well known. Also, there was pictures taken by a Russian spy satellite of Area 51, which were published in a leading magazine in the United States, Popular Science at the time. And that gave Americans, that was in the early 70s, and it gave Americans, most Americans, their first view of the base from an aerial photograph perspective.
Mm-hmm.
We had one of the, one of the astronauts, I've forgotten now which mission, that took a picture of Area 51 as well. And there were many, many mix-ups and releases of information where there shouldn't have been. There was a document released from the CIA which mentioned specifically the Oxcart spy plane, which was still classified top secret in 1967-68 time period. And they mention in this document release that the Oxcart had been moved from Area 51 to Vietnam, had been deployed.
Mm-hmm.
So in that little sentence is discovered, you know, two very highly classified things at the time, the Oxcart stealth aircraft and the existence of Area 51 as a place where secret aircraft are developed and tested. So
mm-hmm.
there were many information leaks. We had several crashes that I mentioned, you know, pilots testing experimental aircraft that crashed around Nevada and surrounding states. And in the news story about the crash, sometimes the pilot was killed, sometimes they ejected safely. There were mentions about Area 51 being a secret test facility for these types of planes. So there was a preponderance of evidence if anybody had bothered to look and piece it all together, which is easy to say now, as mm-hmm. I mentioned previously.
Well, what's interesting, and I don't know if you've ran across this, but I certainly have quite a bit, and it was kind of one of the takes the media took when, a couple years ago when it finally, you know, the name Area 51 was finally released and declassified, is this idea that Area 51 didn't exist. A lot of people, I don't know if you ran across this, where people had told you, oh, I don't believe in Area 51. And their main reason was, is I don't believe in UFOs. Well, you don't have to believe in UFOs to believe in Area 51. But it seems like this attachment to UFOs, for some reason, led people to then disbelieve Area 51 existed at all. Have you ran across that?
Oh, absolutely. But I think part of that is the static that's been caused by so many strange TV shows and movies where every sort of strange theory, from teleportation to time travel to alien breeding experiments that are supposedly are taking place out there. You know, maybe some of that is occurring, but we have no hard evidence. And so what these weird outlandish theories do is they turn a lot of people off to the whole topic.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, they suddenly are not as interested in finding out, you know, that there's a fascinating history behind Area 51. It's full of Cold War themes from the 50s. You know, it talks about the rise of our country as an atomic power, the invention of nuclear weapons, the invention of stealth technology, which
mm-hmm.
continues to this day.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you can't throw out the baby with the bathwater. There's Area 51. It's very clear that Area 51 is an important military installation in the United States. And all of what goes on there is secret, even though we know now, we've gotten confirmation that a base called Area 51 exists. But now we know also that a lot of secret aircraft have been tested and are being tested there, and drones.
Mm-hmm.
And witnesses have come forward to say that some of this might be ET in nature.
Right, yeah. And I mean, one of these outlandish stories you're talking about is Bob Lazar's story is really outlandish. And I'm going to explore the idea and talk at the museum in September of the possibility that people have suggested. And I think you and I talked about how weird Bob Lazar's case is that perhaps it is government disinformation of some sort. If it was, it worked well because people didn't believe Area 51 existed for so long because of this attachment to aliens. So I don't know if that's the case. It's just going to talk about how weird it is and mirrored up to other possible government disinformation programs out there.
But the Bob Lazar story is fascinating, and it's certainly worthy of people investigating it, reading both sides of the issue. You know, anytime somebody comes forward with a story about UFOs, there's immediately a counterattack. So, you know, one never knows what's going on because, once again, we use the Hall of Mirrors analogy that Leonard Stringfield said. But, you know, a lot of people have placed a lot of value on Bob Lazar's claims initially. That he worked at a secret facility adjacent to Area 51, and that at this facility he saw UFOs being reverse engineered by the military intelligence complex of the U.S. government. So initially there was this rush, and actually we all owe a debt of gratitude to Mr. Lazar, because he really focused attention on Area 51 and what's going out there for the very first time in a major way. Although there had been previous discussion, there had been previous reports. As you pointed out to me, there had been some television specials done in the Las Vegas area about, you know, the secrets of Area 51 prior to Lazar's revelation, and there had been some newspaper articles and magazine articles that I found in my research prior to Lazar coming forward. But really, the watershed event in the public's attention in the United States and the world being focused on Area 51 was Bob Lazar coming forward with his incredible story of having worked at S4 and having seen actual UFOs being reverse engineered. It's amazing. Amazing story to this day. And what I find extremely interesting, Alejandro, in seeing the latest interviews with Bob that have been done by George Knapp and others, and his recent talks that he's done in public after a long period of time when he gave no public talks and gave no public interviews, I find his demeanor and his attitude and the way he expresses his experience very fascinating. It seems to be, you know, he says things like, "I wish I had never come forward with this. I have gained nothing from it." People are thinking that every evening a huge truck full of cash pulls up in my driveway and dumps a load of money on me. He said, "It actually has been a liability to me in my..." He owns a business that sells scientific instruments, like for lab work and stuff. So it's been a major liability to him. And so he continues to make statements in which he says he wishes he had never come forward, which he still sticks to the story and the authenticity of it, he claims. But he just wishes he had never told anybody about it. So that's an interesting attitude.
Yeah. Well, we've only got a few minutes, and I really want to get to Cowboys and Aliens. So this is a cool little book that you created where you found news clippings, right, of UFO stories or alien stories going back into U.S. cowboy history.
Yeah, once again, it's the librarian researcher in me. In 2007, Ruben and I were invited to speak at the Roswell UFO Festival, and we ended up going back every year for 5 years. And during that time, we ran across a very nice young man in Roswell whose name is John LeMay, and he's a historian. He specializes in the Old West time period, especially New Mexico and surrounding states. Billy the Kid, Pat Garrett, stories like that. He's published a number of books on Old West history and historical figures and events, the OK Corral and stuff like that. So we met John, and John has born and raised in Roswell, but he's not really into the whole UFO thing. He has kind of a detached interest because it's hard to live in Roswell and not be exposed to it, as you well know, Alejandro. But John is on the board of the Historical Society for Southeastern New Mexico, and he was introduced to us, and I struck up a relationship with him over email and phone. And somehow John found out ahead, like a year ahead of time, possibly before it was made public, that Steven Spielberg had a movie about to come out called Cowboys and Aliens. So being a historian specializing in the Old West, he was very interested in an immediate question that came to his mind was, were there UFO sightings in the 1800s during the Wild West? So he got on the phone to me. I remember he called me one day and he said, you know, I heard that Spielberg is doing a movie about cowboys encountering aliens, or people in the 1800s encountering aliens. So I said, at that time I had been working on a book about historic Texas UFO cases, and I had compiled a number of cases that occurred in the 1800s in Texas. So I told John, I already have a file folder of some cases from Texas in the 1800s. So he said, well, let's do a book about it. And Ruben Uriarte helped us with the research. He contributed a number of articles or information that made its way into the final book. But the outcome was the book that I did with John LeMay called The Real Cowboys and Aliens. And interestingly enough, Alejandro, it was published on the very day that the Spielberg movie was released.
Oh, that's funny.
So so we got some really cool reviews. Auspicious. About Yeah, we got some really cool reviews from a number of publications, including the Albuquerque Journal, in which basically the reviewer said stuff like, there's this new movie out with lots of explosions and ugly looking aliens that kill people and gunfighters that engage in gunfights with the aliens. But if you want to know the truth about UFO encounters in the 1800s, take a look at this book.
Mm-hmm.
So we did very well with the book in terms of sales. It was quite popular. And both John LeMay and myself, as well as Ruben, have actually been called on many times to speak about this little book because people seem to really like it and identify with it. And I think one of the main elements that this brings to the table, and Ruben and I were just invited to speak about it at the MUFON Orange County meeting last month, and the folks at Orange County told us that what really appealed to them is this element of, in the 1800s, there was no manned flight of any kind. So if there's something flying around in the air, we know that it's not one of ours. You know, post-1900, we had Orville and Wilbur Wright. We had the development of aircraft. We had steerable dirigibles. We had many aircraft after 1900, but the period from 1800 to 1899, which is what we cover in this book, there weren't any of ours flying around up there. And yet we had people reporting silver metallic discs in the skies.
Wow.
Encounters with entities that look very much like the Greys and similar beings that have been made popular after the 40s. All of this was going on in the 1800s. Well, we know that UFO encounters date way back in human history, even to way before 1800. But what's interesting, again, is that during this Old West period, we had farmers and ranchers throughout North America reporting encounters with UFOs and the entities inside of them. Mm-hmm. And that was a fascinating revelation to me as we did the research for this book. And it continues to be one of my personal favorites. And it's something that, in particular, kids and young people really love. Because many of them have seen the movie, and they're very interested in the topic, and they love it. And so we lecture to young people a lot.
How many cases are in the book about?
Well, John LeMay and I looked at over 100 cases prior to publishing the book. But we targeted the book to middle school, high school audience. We wanted to keep it short and sweet. We used a lot of illustrations, some remarkable work done by Neil Reby, who is he's a great comic book illustrator and magazine illustrator. He's a Godzilla fanatic. He draws a lot for Godzilla fan magazines.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, yeah, he did a fantastic job. By the way, I don't know if you knew this or not, but Ruben and Uriarte and I are both huge Godzilla fans.
Me too.
We have all the movies on DVD. And during a recent trip where we both went to speak at the same conference, we were sharing a hotel room, and we would watch late into the night. We watched Godzilla flicks. I mean, that was how we passed the time together. But anyway, Neil Reby did a fantastic job of illustrating our book because, of course, back then we had no photography of these encounters. So he took the eyewitness descriptions as published in the magazines and newspapers of the time, and he did a fantastic job of illustrating.
This has been a great talk. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. And, of course, people can find out more about this book and your other books at roswellbooks.com, right?
That's correct. Thank you very much for having me on today, and look forward to being on your show soon again.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Yes, you're welcome, and we'll see you. Take care.
Thank you so much to Noe Torres. Be sure to check him out at Roswell Books, where you can find his books and also those of Ruben Uriarte. I think they've always written together, but interesting stuff. Roswell's or Mexico's Roswell, Cowboys and Aliens, and other really cool books you'll be able to check out there. And also thank you, of course, to Martin Willis of Podcast UFO for joining us with the news. Always exciting and fun to talk to Martin. So a great show. Thanks, guys, so much for joining me. And thank you all for joining me, of course. Thank you to Caleb Hanks for the opening and closed music. You can find him at The Clerk Chronicles. There's a link to The Clerk Chronicles on our UFO radio page at openminds.tv, and you could go download his music for free. The other thing that you'll find at openminds.tv, of course, are all of the news stories that Martin and I talked about, and then some. So we've got news going up every day. Check that out. We didn't have a UFO report on YouTube last week because I was on vacation. This week, our video guy's on vacation, so we won't have one this week, but we will have one next week, and it will be spectacular. In fact, we have other videos in the works as well for YouTube. So if you're not a subscriber to our YouTube page, be sure to do that. Go look for Open Minds TV, or you can put Open Minds Production and find us there. And of course, you can find us at openminds.tv, because coming up, we've got a really comprehensive piece on the main Allagash incident that Martin and I were speaking about at the beginning of the show. And of course, I've got several interviews about. So I think that after this, already we're probably one of the best resources for information on that case, because we had one of the guys at the UFO Congress last year, and of course we had interviews with the others. So really exciting case, really interesting stuff. So I think you're going to find this terribly, terribly interesting and entertaining. So be sure to check out our YouTube for that. As for the UFO Congress, I'm My goal is this week to make the first announcement of the first batch of speakers. I've already shared with you all some of the great speakers that we're going to have there. And that was exclusive to you all. Nobody else knows. So you all should feel very special and privileged. You are the special class. But we're going to have the rest of those, or at least more of those, announced hopefully this week, which is really exciting because we've got some really great people that will be speaking at the UFO Congress. That's going to be February 17th to the 21st. And I implore you all to go reserve your room as soon as possible because those go quickly. And from what I understand, we are getting really close to already having the hotel sold out where the event is. However, there are nearby hotels that will shuttle you over. So no problem, no worries if you can't do that right now, even though it really doesn't cost anything. You just make sure you get a room. But if you don't want to do that now, no worries. You'll still be able to get in. I know some of you are still figuring out your plans for vacations and whatnot. The other thing, be sure and watch the page also for another exciting story that we're going to be posting this week. I think it's cool and some of the best work in this field that's ever been done. So a great analysis. There's a little sneak peek for you of something really cool. We'll definitely talk about it on the next show. But also be sure and sign up for our email newsletter. We do have a sign-up little thing on openminds.tv on the upper right-hand corner. You'll be able to see a little blue box where you can put your email address in there and sign up for the newsletter. We only send out one email every other week. Once in a while, we'll probably send out an extra one to promote special things. But trust me, it's only going to be for things that are really important and that you all are going to want to know about. But if you sign up for that newsletter, you'll be able to keep up to date. We keep you up to date on the latest UFO reports, on the latest things going on with the UFO Congress, and of course, everything else that is going on with openminds.tv. So our cool new stories, everything. So if you want to keep up to date on everything going on, I think it's really important for you to get on this email list. As soon as we're done here, go sign up for that. Otherwise, thank you all again so much for being on the show. Next week, we'll have more news and from some of the experts regarding this exciting story that I have teased you about but have told you nothing about coming up this week. But trust me, you're going to really like it. And so we'll have more about that on the show next week. We'll have more about it on our UFO report. We'll have more about it on our website as soon as tomorrow. So be sure and check that out. Otherwise, you guys have a wonderful week and adios, muchachos. Your emotions.